Good evening, and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Wednesday, December 7th, 2016. A South Sudanese official defends the government's right to deport any non-South Sudanese citizen after a foreign journalist is deported.
We are not the only country that has deported a journalist now. Not journalists, any non-South Sudanese can be deported. If he or she is found to be in conflict with the law.
And a top African Union official is in South Sudan demanding that the government protect women's rights.
When we say restoring the dignity of the women of South Sudan, is that for them they see justice, they see security around them, and they have even the human face of security.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. But first, local leaders in Yei River State say unknown gunmen abducted the commissioner of Kangapo County, which was formed out of Kajokeji County to become a standalone county. Leaders say Julius Tabule was abducted in Bori Payam on Sunday as he headed to a funeral service. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Juba.
Yei River State Governor David Lokonga Moses says the abductors drove away with Tabule and three of his bodyguards in a government car. Lokonga says the motive for Tabule's abduction is unclear, and he is asking that the commissioner be released immediately and unconditionally.
It's very unfortunate, and this is one of the areas I don't understand whether this is a practice of terrorism or what, because you cannot abduct somebody against his will and you take him under gunpoint. Up to now, I did not get any information because I've informed the security to try to establish the incident, even that happened, and the call of where he is.
Governor Lokonga calls County Commissioner Tabule a good servant to his community. He says he did not report any threats on his life.
He's doing his job. He's going on well, and I did not get any threat. Always he's giving me reports of improvement of security.
Commissioner Tabule was appointed in August after Lokonga split the original four counties of Yei River, Kajokeji, Morobo, and Lanya into 13, which now make up the newly created Yei River State. Lokonga urges citizens not to panic over what he termed as an isolated incident.
I'm appealing, for releasing the commissioner unconditionally and unharmed. What has happened, and later I call on the people of Kajokeji, especially in Kangapo, to remain calm.
Julius Lokonga, commissioner of neighboring Nyepo County, says the overwhelming majority of residents in his county have remained calm after the abduction, but acknowledges that some people have fled to neighboring Uganda.
There are people, of course, who are staying. And there are those who feel maybe because of his abduction and they started fearing and started moving away from the area there. But majority of the people are just within.
Commissioner Lokonga says despite what happened to Tabule, the state government will do all it can to ensure the safety and security of area citizens. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
The large influx of South Sudan refugees into Uganda since July is taking a toll on the Ugandan government and donor support. Relief organizations like the World Food Program, or WFP, are seeking more donations to help feed the refugees. Reporter Catherine Nambi has more on the story from Kampala.
The UN Refugee Agency says Uganda is currently hosting about 590,000 South Sudan refugees and asylum seekers. The UNHCR says most of the refugees fled after renewed fighting between forces loyal to President Salva Kiir and his then-Vice President Riek Machar in July of this year. Olivia Sara is one of those who fled Juba during detentions.
I come from Juba because of that area is not good for me. My mother is not there. My mother, when these people they are fighting, I'm from hospital, and when I come back, I'm not getting at home.
The refugee host communities are feeling strained and are calling for a permanent resettlement camp or transit center for the refugees. Jake Ochan, Community Development Officer in the Lamu District of Northern Uganda, explains.
There is issue of clean water, which we need also to share with the refugees coming, issues of immunization against some of the common killer diseases. And our brothers and sisters who are coming from Southern Sudan is putting pressure also on the current or the little food that we have among the population. We want to see a permanent solution for the future, whether we can have transit center or a permanent resettlement center, whether in Lamu or any neighboring district, that at the end will help us to really support our brothers.
Margaret Babadiri is a member of parliament in Koboko, one of the refugee host districts in northern Uganda. She says leaders have asked their people to accommodate the refugees.
Indeed, the situation of refugees is overwhelming. The refugees who come through Oraba, some of them are taken to Reno camp, others are taken to Yumbe, but the majority have decided to live within Koboko. We welcome them because most of them are actually related to us. Some are Kakwas, some are Lumadis, and even Acholis. They are all related to us, so we welcome them, but we need to live in harmony with them.
Cheryl Harrison, Deputy Country Director for the World Food Programme in Uganda, says the refugee numbers are overwhelming.
We're feeding over 300,000 refugees. Many of them are actually from South Sudan. We're feeding in excess of 150,000 from South Sudan at the moment. We're optimistic that the situation in South Sudan will improve, but in the meantime, we'll continue to provide the support that they require.
She says WFP, with the help of donors, distributes cash and food.
So we seek contributions from our donors, from the likes of the US government, from the UK government and from others. And in turn, we then use that money to procure the food and then distribute it into the refugee settlements.
She says, however, that with the surge in the South Sudan refugee population, WFP is appealing for more donor support. Susan Dujang is from Yei, South Sudan. She says the food rations are not enough for her and for her family.
When we arrived here, life was very difficult. But at least now, they are giving water, even though sometimes they used to delay to bring the water. But at least nowadays, we used to stay good. But the problem of food shortage is now a problem to us because the quantity they have given us is little. Like in the morning, we do take porridge. Then afternoon, we don't take anything. We just stay after evening. That's when we shall eat food and sleep. It really affects because the children used to cry that They are hungry. Now, if we are to eat like thrice a day, what if the flour got finished? What next should we do?
The Uganda government has budgeted $42 million to cover the cost of food, water and sanitation, health and education for the refugees. However, it has only secured half of this, making it hard for all refugees to get sufficient relief support. Each South Sudanese refugee in Uganda is entitled to a 50 by 50 plot of land for cultivation and settlement. Refugees also receive materials to build shelters. Refugees have access to health care and education within the host community they live in. They have the right to work and do business, but also have freedom of movement. For VOA, this is Catherine Nambi reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
The Associated Press is reporting that one of its journalists working in South Sudan was arrested and later deported from the country by government agents due to his work in South Sudan. South Sudan Minister of Information Michael McQuay says he is not aware whether or not the American freelance reporter Justin Lynch has been deported and is not able to comment on the circumstances, but notes the government has the legal right to deport non-citizens at any time.
We have the right to deport any journalist who does not conform with our laws, who is in flagrant violation of our laws. We have the right to deport him. This is the right given to in all the countries. South Sudan is not a new. By the way, South Sudan is a new state, but South Sudanese are not new. We know what happens in the world. We are not the only country that has deported a journalist now. Not journalists. Any non-South Sudanese can be deported. If he or she is found to be in conflict with the law. So it is not a matter of being a journalist. Any citizen, any non-citizen, can be deported.
The 25-year-old reporter was ordered out of the country by government agents and put on a plane to Uganda yesterday. The Associated Press says Lynch has been reporting from South Sudan for its news organization since July and most recently wrote about the United Nations warning that the country is at risk of genocide. Lynch told the AP that his mobile phones were temporarily seized by South Sudanese National Security Service, who later allowed him to pick his belongings before ordering him to board the plane to Uganda. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The AU's envoy for women, peace and security says punishing the perpetrators of sexual abuse against women will guarantee the dignity of the victims. We'll have the details when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what do you want to do before you die?
I'd love to make a commemorable event for the whole country, for my country to know, as in to help like a very specific group of people who can remember at any time that I helped them once in a while.
I want to have visited every country in Africa: Nigeria, Liberia, Togo, Cote d'Ivoire, Guinea, all of them. I really want to be there.
Okay, I would want to be successful so that I pay back my parents for what they have invested in me, and of course live a good life.
Now, before I die, I want to be a women activist and the voice for the vulnerable, whether through an already established organization or a CBO, or starting up my own organization.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Today, a top African Union official is calling on South Sudan's government to apprehend and punish soldiers who sexually abused women during the 3 years of conflict in the country. Bileta Diop, the AU's envoy for women, peace and security, says punishing the perpetrators of sexual abuse against women will guarantee the security and dignity of South Sudanese women. Tito Justin reports for VOA from Juba.
Bineta Diop, the AU's special envoy on women, peace and security, is meeting with the South Sudan's gender, child and social welfare minister Awu Deng Achwil, women activists and other individuals about how women's rights can be protected. Diop says the African Union has launched a campaign aimed at restoring the dignity of women in South Sudan and is led by African Union Commission Chairperson Ngozazana Dlamini Zuma.
It's time for us to say to silence the gun in South Sudan. It's time for us to make sure that we bring restore peace in this country, but in particular we restore the dignity of the women of South Sudan. And when we say restoring the dignity of the women of South Sudan, is that for them they see justice, they see security around them, and they have even the human face of security.
Diop says the AU stands with South Sudanese women as they launch this year's 16 days of activism against sexual violence. She says the AU wants women to have a say in finding solutions to South Sudan's widespread problem of sexual abuse against women.
So they deserve to be considered as human beings. So restoring the dignity is for us to stand together as men, as official authorities, our international, as AU, all of us to say that, you know, women of South Sudan have suffered and it's enough. And we need to give them the dignity that they deserve.
She says the voices of victims and survivors trapped in South Sudan's conflict should be heard so that women's rights are guaranteed in the country.
We need also to see peace in South Sudan. But we need also to reconcile. We have been hearing from the messages that the women have brought to us. We need to stop the violence. We need to have that security even in our house, in our family, in our community.
Diop is calling on government officials to enforce the law and arrest and punish the criminals who violate women's rights. Mahawa Kabawila, Director of Women Gender Development at the AU, says the aspiration of women and youth must be recognized. She says the AU wants to see the energy of youth and women making peace a reality in South Sudan.
When there is the right of dignity has been violated, and one of really the fundamentals for that is peace, to guarantee the right of dignity. When there is no peace, there is no human dignity. And the lack of peace means basically that most of your rights do not exist anymore. And as a result, where there is no peace, we feel like there is no human rights to speak of.
U.S. State Department spokesman Mark Turner also released a statement on Monday saying sexual violence has become widespread in South Sudan and the perpetrators of such crimes must be brought to justice. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
Our thanks to Tito for that report. Here in Washington, VOA's William Eagle reports that the United Nations women and other groups are using the end of November and early December to call for an end to violence against women. They're also promoting international and national legislation to protect women and girls and to support community effort to end gender-based abuse.
Women's rights activists say violence comes in many forms, including intimidation, harassment, and rape as a weapon of war. One of the most common is from intimate or family relationships. Statistics tell part of the story. Simone Ellis Oluwatolunya is the Deputy Regional Director for Eastern and Southern Africa for UN Women. She says figures from the African Development Bank show that an estimated 37% of women in sub-Saharan Africa are victims of intimate partner violence. Some research shows a high level of tolerance for wife beating, and some women are among those who support it. UN Women and its partners work to convince the public that domestic violence can no longer be accepted as normal. Oluwatolunya cites a World Bank study of women's attitudes on the topic in Guinea and Mali.
The report says 75% of women report acceptance of wife beating. Socially, it's considered a normal practice. In some situations, not all, but in some situations, it is considered an honor, if you like, that your relationship is strong if you are beaten.
Results of the violence are not just physical and psychological, but also economic. Oluwatolunya says a report by the African Development Bank showed that in Tanzania, female victims of violence earned between 30 to 40% less income than those who had not suffered domestic abuse.
So you're taking productive people out of the economy. You're building on the cost of health care, of counseling, of the justice system. This all adds up.
Violence against women is not just limited to the home. In an age of democratic elections, intimidation has been used against promising women candidates in Côte d'Ivoire, Kenya, Uganda, Nigeria, and Zimbabwe.
That can be in order to discourage the women to go forward for a position, and also it has happened against voters.
In an effort to solve the problem, UN Women is working with national governments and civil society to set up hotlines for use during the election period. Women and others can call in to alert authorities and activists about areas of potential danger to women.
They're able to immediately call through and report the incident. This goes through to our situation room. And in the situation room, we have a network where support can be deployed immediately to the hotspot area. That would be if it's the police or civil society organizations, what have you.
UN Women is engaged with partners in civil society and with national governments to end gender violence in other ways as well. It works, for example, to pass national legislation and improve policies, ensuring justice for women. It also works with local authorities and community leaders, as in this effort described by Oluwatch Olunya.
We are working with the uniformed forces in terms of sensitizing them, giving them clear knowledge and information on what exactly is ending violence against women, what are the existing legislations within the country that will enable them to manage this situation, how it can be documented, and what other areas of support are required for the woman.
In many countries, including Ethiopia and South Africa, UN Women has established shelters where battered women can be safe and find access to medical and legal services. The UN agency also works with men and community leaders to protect women from violence and also from some harmful traditional practices. For example, thousands of young girls each year are harmed while undergoing female circumcision. Others under 18 who are forced to marry are vulnerable to problems during delivery or are at risk of developing fistula. These are tears in the reproductive tract that allow the leakage of body waste, causing pain and often social ostracism. A community leader in Ethiopia who preaches against early marriage and gender-based violence is Archbishop Abune Marcos from the East Gojem Zone Diocese. With the support of UN Women, he has trained more than 300 religious leaders to reject harmful traditional practices and prejudices, some which are justified by what he calls misinterpreted religious principles. Archbishop Marcos says he'd like to help train others in theological schools throughout the country. Education is power and the key to freedom, he says. Development activists agree and add that women's freedom is a crucial part of boosting Africa's development. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
The manner in which we communicate on social media matters during conflict, where it's difficult to verify facts. South Sudanese in the diaspora often express their anger on social media about events happening in their villages. John Tanza, host of South Sudan in Focus, continues our panel discussion about individual accountability when communicating on social media.
Let's look at these issues from our own perspective. Looking at the issue of ignorance, our grandfathers did not go to school, but they did not have hate speech during their time.
First, I'm Irene. I've been watching what's going on, the fights in the media, and some of the women that were actually sending strong message of hate back home. I don't like to mention their names. According to the information that I got was that they were told to say ABCD, and they don't reason it out because they lack that knowledge that when I go out and present a case in public, in media, I'm supposed to digest the message well because it can cause harm.
I disagree with that, Amduku. And yes, this is actually a very strong message that you say that ignorance is a key issue here. It is partially indeed. In that one, I agree because you can see very educated people yet put out, it can come from high top officials, a message of hate to your officials. It can come at the level of a government as well. And I will assume a government will be somebody who is well-educated, well-trained. If you send out phrases of hate messages or a strong, violent message to your people, that in itself is giving simple person like me, a normal citizen like me, that, oh, it's okay to talk about a hate message.
You struck a very important point here, that the way we speak out matters. One thing you're saying is that there are certain words you cannot even use it in your house. And using it on the social media is even adding more fire to the already burning bush. Now, somebody can come in and, chip in, please.
Yeah, so this is Dao. I disagree with Sister Irene. I think we cannot equate ignorance with a level of education. It's the people that are supposedly educated, who have degrees, who are held up as the standard in our culture, in our society, that are the ones perpetrating. They're the ones that are leading this deep divide of social media hatred, right? And then another thing, you talk about as hatred being deeply in our hearts. I think it's one thing if your relatives were killed, you have every right to be angry. You have every right to express yourself. No problem, right? But I think if you want to our society, our country forward, you need to think about how are we going to solve these issues.
John Tanza, can I jump in?
Yes, go ahead, Dennis. Go ahead.
This is Dennis. The other thing, like John Tanza, you talk about hate speech, but some of the people who came out with hate speech, they were people with their level of education wasn't that much. But the thing is, they were being supported by people who are really very educated. When they post something, people who comment, people who cheer them up are very educated people, although their voice, they don't put it that public, but they were cheering them. So this is another way of encouraging hate speech that I'm looking at, or not saying something when somebody from your community put out something like a hate speech. You don't come out with your opinion. I see it's another way of making hate speech to go forward. So that's my take that I'm seeing, that maybe those are the things that we should look more to that.
That's Irene, who works as an accountant in Minnesota. Dr. Juku Wakason, who is a medical doctor, chairperson of the Western Bahr el-Ghazal community in England, and founder of United WOW, a social group. Dao Dut Jok is founder of the Dut Jok Youth Foundation. And Dennis Lisa is an accountant in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. The four South Sudanese shared their views about individual accountability when communicating on social media to avoid spreading hate speech. Tomorrow, we discuss the role of education and hate speech. Street beats, go get 'em. And that's our show for this Wednesday. We leave you with the song Zero to Hero by Edem featuring Aquaboa.
Go get 'em. I see them breezes on my feet. No. But I go dance to the rhythm of the beat. Yeah. I know see, sometimes I fall on my knees. Dance to pretty and ponyan coupon. Go give me some peace. I can't baby me feeling the amount. Energy on soon, I'm on the amount. Still trading and posat, so could have moved. I go give you thanks and praise. Yeah, me feeling the amount. Energy on soon, I'm on the amount. Still trading and posat, so could have moved. I'll give you thanks and praise. My weight is over, and it's off my shoulders. Now I'm moving higher, and I'm moving, I'm moving, and I'm moving, I'm moving. I'm moving from zero to hero. Wow, wow. Zero to hero. Yeah, zero to hero.
Side gale, and 2G and I get chony, get chony. These things say I go look funny, like joke, get to you, make money. In a pause, they give me orders, but lately they take my order. Way to make move across the border, next year, Adam, featuring Rihanna. Amazing grace, yeah, me and new sick of plum. Vado off his seam, my dope, back in the days. Nama kwa maro dom, hafi nudu duado. Vanya my cheese, you I get faint. I'm a genuine G, my bandage. A shot, I don't go make a good die. Zero to hero, smooth on the right. Street beat.
Now my waist is over. And it's off my shoulders. Now I'm moving higher. And I'm moving, I'm moving. And I'm moving, I'm moving. I'm moving from zero to hero.
Wow. 2G10, I get my own key. Yeah.
We've been listening to Edem featuring Akwaboah with the song Zero to Hero. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Asiko pampana, ziko pa. Kovu vada koro koma, gere. Yamadi diga jaba.